Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hey everybody, this is Cale Clark, and this is The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. So good to have you with me once again. Let's open up our Bibles to Exodus chapter 23, brand new chapter today. And this is really intriguing. We'll see today how Jesus didn't come up with some radically different teaching that was just completely out of line with anything that had ever been seen in Israel. We're going to see another example of how He's in perfect continuity with the way God has always taught from the beginning. God is always the same, and He always acts in the same way throughout the two Testaments. Let's take a look at these laws that are mentioned. Again, these are expansions of the Ten Commandments, if you will, the case laws of ancient Israel. Let's look at chapter 23, the first little section here. It says, "You shall not utter a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a suit, turning aside after a multitude so as to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his suit." Okay, let's stop here for just a minute. It has nothing to do with wearing three-piece suits, of course. This is having to do with court cases. This is justice in ancient Israel. So what's interesting here is that, and let's actually just skip ahead just a little bit. If you want to look with me to, I'm going to deal with verses 4 and 5 separately. Let's jump ahead to verse 6. It says, "You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his suit. Keep far from a false charge. Do not slay the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the officials and subverts the cause of those who are in the right." Okay, so now sandwich in between there, there's some other teaching which I'm going to get to in just a second, but I want to comment on these laws about justice, court proceedings, the way they should go. Bribery, not a good deal. Of course, it does happen all the time behind the scenes and certain cities, which I will not name. I'm not going to mention anything, but you probably heard about this going down. Gotham City obviously was rife with bribery. I'm just kidding. I'm a big Batman fan. Harvey Dent tried to clean it up, but we know what happened to him, right? Even he got sucked in a certain sense, by the Joker. All right, we're off track here. Let's get back to Exodus. So what's going on here is that court proceedings have to be fair, and they have to be fair and just towards the rich and the poor. This is interesting because there is a tendency in some circles to have what's called a preferential option for the poor, or maybe skew things towards the poor in their favor. But the text here also presents the rich as deserving of justice. Nobody should be offered favoritism. Everybody should be judged fairly. Now, what's interesting is that in our own culture today, in the 21st century, especially in the West, the pendulum seems to be swinging towards favoritism for the poor. The rich are often seen as evil. The 1%, for example, which they're labeled derisively by some others. There are a lot of people in Western society that would love to introduce some form of communism in the culture. They'd be more than happy, if given the chance, to seize the assets of the wealthy. People who are people of means are very often automatically assumed to be corrupt people who have not come by their means honestly. We have to be extremely careful about all of this, because don't forget that in the gospel, there are several people who are people of means who are presented as being very righteous. People like Nicodemus, who does the right thing. He's a member of the ruling council. Joseph of Arimathea, together, they give Jesus a proper burial. From their means, from their considerable means, they use it to serve the Lord. There are, of course, others who donated to the apostolic band out of their largesse in order to keep Jesus and his apostles going, keep them fed on their journeys. So just being simply a wealthy person does not mean that you are corrupt by any stretch of the imagination. It is, however, a challenge. As Jesus talks about elsewhere in the gospel, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a wealthy person to enter the kingdom of God. And by the way, he really does mean a sewing needle. There's a fiction that's out there. It's a bit of an urban legend. And perhaps you've heard this if you've been on a tour to the Holy Land. Sometimes unsuspecting pilgrims are duped by very creative tour guides, and they'll take you to a little gate outside the old city walls of Jerusalem. And they'll say, this is the needle gate. This is what Jesus was talking about when he talked about the eye of the needle. Because camels, people would ride camels back in the Middle Ages, and they would have to, and in Jesus' day as well, and they would have to, the camels would kneel down. They'd have to get on their knees to get down and through the gate because it was so low. Well, the needle gate, the so-called needle gate, was not there in Jesus' day. So that's not what he's talking about. That was added much later in the Middle Ages. And very often these small gates would prevent marauders from coming into holy sites. We see this in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. There's a very small gate there, and that was because Muslim invaders would often try to ride their horses into the Christian sites during the period of the Crusades, that sort of thing, and disrupt things, to say the least. So they would create these small gates horses couldn't get through. Anyways, that's not what Jesus was talking about. The actual word he was using was the Greek word for a sewing needle, specifically the kind used in surgery to stitch people up. Dr. Luke, especially in his gospel, that's the word he uses. And he's just amazed by this, because as a physician, he knows exactly what Jesus means. And clearly it is impossible for a camel to go through the eye of a sewing needle. But Jesus says nothing is impossible with God. It is possible, but detachment is the key. Stewardship is the key. The key is putting everything one has at the disposal of Jesus Christ. That's what Nicodemus did. That's what Joseph of Arimathea did. And sometimes that's a lot more difficult than if you're a person who's poor. It's perhaps easier to be detached because you have nothing to be detached from. But maybe not. Just being poor doesn't make you automatically spiritual either. There are several, maybe millions of poor people who, if given the chance, would actually be avaricious also. St. Jose Maria Escrivá told the story of a guy who I'm going to call Spoon Man, to reference an old song by Chris Cornell. There was a guy in the Spanish Civil War who, at a soup kitchen, St. Jose Maria would see him in the soup kitchen. It was a really horrible time for everyone in that society. And he had this special pewter spoon. It was his own personal spoon. He wouldn't share it with anyone else. It was very much like, you know, the ring, Gollum's ring and the Lord of the Rings, you know, my precious. He was attached to this thing. He had no possessions to his name other than this pewter spoon, but this was his idol in a certain sense. And so anything can become an idol. Anything in the material world can be a barrier between us and God, instead of being something that we put at God's disposal. And so this is what we really need to think about as we're looking at this text. So there are the down and outs, if you will. There are also the up and outs. There are people who have means, who have no spiritual life going on. They need the gospel just as much as anyone else. And there are also destitute people, or people that are struggling financially. They need the gospel as well. Not all of them are necessarily spiritual just because they are poor. Although I would say, though, the poor do tend to trust God a little bit more. They have to look to God more for their daily needs, where it's very easy for people who are comfortable to forget about God and think that they've done it all on their own. And so all of that is kind of in the background here. I want to jump back to verses 4 and 5. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. I want to jump back to verses 4 and 5 of Exodus 23. It says, if you meet your enemy's ox, or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall help him to lift it up. Okay, so what we have here again is an expansion of the Ten Commandments. Now, in general, what we have here is an expansion of the commandments regarding other people. Commandments 4 through 10, the last seven, it's love and action. It's loving your neighbor as you love yourself. Obviously, the first three of the Ten Commandments are about God, the last seven about loving neighbor. And these are the ones that prove that you do love God. As John the Apostle says in one of his letters, if you don't love your brother or sister whom you do see, don't tell me that you love God whom you can't see, because this is practical love for God expressed in action, the love of neighbor. And Jesus taught this. He says, when he gives this sort of précis of what the law is all about, it's about loving God and loving neighbor, loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving your neighbor as yourself. So then the question becomes, who is my neighbor? And Jesus, of course, gets asked that question. He responds with the parable of the Good Samaritan. And the Samaritans were, in some ways, enemies to the Israelites. And so what we have here back in Exodus 23, and we know very well that Jesus did teach love for enemies, but this is, again, not a new thing. This is not original to Jesus. It's original to God, but of course there's continuity. Jesus is God, and this is what God has taught all along. So what we have here, a couple of cases here in these verses 4 and 5. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. Okay, that's one thing. All right, my enemy's animal is wandering in my field. I guess I should return it, even though I don't like this guy at all. But the next verse, verse 5, involves much more sacrifice. It says, if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall help him to lift it up. So let's say the donkey has collapsed. It's carrying all this weight. It's a hot day. It's thirsty. It can't do it anymore. It's going to pass out. Your neighbor comes. You have to help this guy lift up all the stuff the donkey was carrying, help him bring it back home. Even though this guy hates you, you might hate this person. This is personal sacrifice, loving your enemy. It's easy to love our friends, as Jesus talks about in the gospel. It is far more difficult. But that's what everybody does. That's what pagans do, as the Lord says. So if you, what are you doing more than them if you're just loving your friends and family who love you back? You've got to go above and beyond. And this is exactly what God does. He calls the rain and the sun to fall on the righteous and on the unrighteous, on those who are grateful and those who are not. And this is expanded upon later in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 1 through 4. It's kind of the same stuff. It says, you shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep go astray and withhold your help from them. You shall take them back to your brother. And if he is not near you, or if you do not know him, you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall be with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. And so you shall do with his donkey, so you shall do with his garment, so you shall do with any lost thing of your brother's which he loses and you find. You may not withhold your help. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and withhold your help from them. You shall help him to lift them up again. So when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 to 48, when we read these words, it makes a lot more sense. Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even tax collectors do the same? And if you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And by the way, when Jesus says be perfect, he doesn't mean be impeccable. You're going to be sinless as he was. That's not what it means. Well, of course, we strive for that. But the perfection that we can attain in this life with God's help is perfection in love, having a heart of love and the will to do God's will, the will to love enemies, even though it doesn't feel good, even though it doesn't feel good. So you see the continuity here. Again, once again, this thought that people have that Jesus made some radical break with Judaism is preposterous. God always is the same throughout history. Jesus is simply just restating what's here, giving the correct interpretation of the law. And I have to say also, I have grown in my understanding of this as well. I always used to say that Jesus was giving sort of the heart of the law, the interior disposition that we ought to have, whereas the old covenant was more about external behaviors. Don't do this, do this. But even the old covenant is also about internal attitudes that we have to have towards people. And so, very, very intriguing stuff here. Now, there's just this little section here about the Sabbath. And again, this is an expansion on the commandments, specifically the commandment to keep the Sabbath holy. Let's check this out. Let's look at verses 10 through 13. It says, "For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its field, in its yield. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the wild beasts may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your maidservant and the alien may be refreshed. Take heed to all that I've said to you, and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let such be heard out of your mouth." So this is interesting because in ancient Israel, we see that there are three different Sabbaths. If you read the Old Testament, there are really three kinds of Sabbaths in ancient Israel. Obviously, the first one was the weekly Sabbath day. That's, of course, mentioned in the Ten Commandments. We talked about this before. Also, every 7 years, this is what's mentioned here in chapter 23, a Sabbath of the land, if you will. Every seventh year, they were not to harvest the land. They were just to leave it fallow and not really cultivate it, not try to do any agriculture. And then, of course, the third Sabbath is the Jubilee year. Every 50 years, there is a Jubilee year in Israel. Slaves were set free, bondservants, debts were forgiven. It was like Control-Alt-Delete. It's a refresh, a fresh start. It's kind of like when we go to confession. And so the land also needs a rest. And we know, obviously, farmers know this. Modern technology has shown that it is actually good to give the land a break every once in a while because it helps it to be more fertile in the future. But this is something else here. This is a 7 year itch that needs to be scratched, if you will. The vineyard, olive vineyards, the land needs to be left alone. And anything that grows there, hey, it's fair game for the poor. They can take from the land, the wild animals, no problem. They can have whatever they can find to eat as well. What's going on here? What is going on here? Is this just so that the poor can eat? Is this just a way of taking care of the poor? I don't know. Because if it's only every 7 years, what are they doing the rest of the time? How are you helping the poor the rest of the time? There are all kinds of theories about this. We're going to get into this a little bit more in the next episode because we've run out of time once again. So much to talk about, so much fun that we're having together on The Faith Explained. But I want to tell you that you can get every episode that you've missed in this series, the Exodus series, or any of our other series. You can go to relevantradio.com. You can go to the Faith Explained page there. Just go to our shows, find The Faith Explained. You can share, you can download the podcasts of the shows. Give them to a friend. Tell them about it. But of course, we're also on the Relevant Radio app. We're archived there. At least the last several episodes are there. And you can go to the show page. You can share it with a friend. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the usual suspects. Wherever good podcasts are, we try to be there as well as we continue our mission here at Relevant Radio of bringing Christ to the world through the media. This is Cale Clark for The Faith Explained. We'll catch you in the next episode of The Faith Explained. God bless you. Peace.